as you may or may not know, every October is the Pomo Honoring Month. And we have every year for a number of years now had Molin Malakai and Rose Hammock in the studio to tell us about what it's all about, what the Pomo project is, and what's happening with the Pomo, obviously, in this area. And there's a lot of things happening in this October, and they're really just starting gearing up with this interview, and there'll be a number more things for the rest of the month. Hi. Rose, say
hello.
Hi.
Well, welcome, and let's talk about the what's happening this month, first of all, obviously, because things are happening in quite quick succession from now.
Mm-hmm. So tomorrow we are going to be having a basket workshop with Buffy Schmidt, who is Pomo, and she's going to be doing twine-style Pomo basketry with our community. It is for at least 12 years and up. Just because of the skill that's kind of needed to work with the materials. Hmm. And she's local. Besides her basketry, she does a lot of different beadwork. And like myself, she traditional dances and travels in those ways.
Twine style, do you know something about that?
So twine style of basketry is a little more, I don't want to say simple, but the style is not as intricate as other baskets. So like comparing a twine basket to say a feather basket or a baby basket, those take a lot more time because the style that they're woven in and how tightly they're woven and just depending on what materials you use, twine baskets are typically just a lot easier just to gather the materials for and to make up a basket. And they could be used for different things too.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Carry on. I interrupted you there.
It's okay. And then, as usual, on Sunday, we'll have our Sonoma County Pomo dancers, whose leader is Joe Salinas, and we're a local dance group here in Sonoma County. We dance at Sebastopol's Farmers Market. Every year, we get invited back to go. And that's always really nice to be able to educate more, I guess you can say more in like a hands-on type of way because it's one thing to hear about our dances, but to be able to hear our songs and to hear the dancer, like the men dancers have loud whistles and, you know, a lot of our dancers have different jewelry. So you hear the jewelry that they wear too. And I think for a lot of people who aren't around this culture all the time or they've never been able to experience it firsthand, for them to be able to see it in such a local place, I feel like it helps us connect with our community better too.
Right. Oh, it's so dramatic and beautiful, everything. There's so many adjectives to it when you're doing that. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So now you started, just to go on a bit of a side, you started dancing at a very young age.
So unlike a lot of my relatives that dance, I wasn't into our culture till I was about 11 or 12. Mm. A lot of our kids that I dance with at least are very young. Hmm. There's some kids in our group that start 2, 3, 4 years old dancing.
Okay.
And I feel like as they stick around our culture, it kind of keeps them grounded and it gives them something positive in our more modern community. Cause living in the city is a lot different than living on a reservation or a rural area. And so here in our cities, not just specifically Santa Rosa or Sebastopol, but just our cities in general, it's easier for our youth to kind of get off track because there's so many negative things out in our community.
Right.
In Santa Rosa alone, you know, there's gangs that those don't get talked about very often, but they're right. Prevalent in our community. Different opioid things going on.
Right.
You know, suicide, all these different factors, but I think a lot of the times we kind of tiptoe around those conversations because they're painful or they, you know, right. Bring up memories, but they're real things that we face in our community. And so to just having just one dance group and being able to bring a lot of the young kids, especially our young boys, it gives them something positive and it gives them that ownership of, you know, being involved in their culture and being able to tell kids at their school or in their community that they're involved in that way.
Very, very important. My goodness, there's got to be those lines.
Mm-hmm. So also on October 27th at 3 o'clock, we're going to be having our Pomo Elders Forum. And Mullen actually came up with the idea for this. We're fortunate enough to be working with CIMCC, which is the California Indian Museum and Cultural Center. Hmm. They're within Santa Rosa, but specifically like the Larkfield area. They do a really good job at representing our California Indian community here. And we're really fortunate that they're allowing us to use their community room to have this forum. Mullen wants to add anything more to it.
Yeah. It's a forum that will have elders who grew up in this area. Mm. What most people don't understand is the troubles you have as a minority growing up in this society. Most people don't know the problems that we have growing up. And so part of this forum is to explain different variations of people encountering the white society for the first time or experiencing what it's like to be a native in this area. And most people have no idea what that is because Indians live in another society, so to speak. We can pretend to live in this society so we look like this everyone else. But there's a society that goes inner that most people don't know about and most people don't understand. So we're trying to explain that to people, like, what does it mean? For me, like, it was the first time I had what I call white man's food. We never had that. And so we call it white man's food. And it's those kind of things like that, right. That what happened to us in the
first transition,
time.
That interchange place is always the critical point, isn't it?
So I didn't have a white man's food until I went to grammar school. Mm. And so they would buy a lunch for us to eat lunch, but it was all kinds of food that I never had before. And my teacher was Mrs. Ward. She's gone. But she was very insistent that everyone eat all the things on the plate. Mm. And you couldn't go outside unless you finished your plate. So I would try to eat, but I would throw up and she would make me eat the food, even though I didn't want to. So I had a friend next to me, Anthony Emmert, who liked to eat. So I would pass my food on to him, and he would clean my plate. So I would pass through and get a clean plate. And there was the cook, who was a Mrs. Van Horn. So
she's amazing. We remember those names from so long ago. I know exactly what you mean.
And I couldn't put my arms around her, but she was big. But she knew I didn't eat, and so she gave me for the first time what I call white man's bread. And put honey on it. So I would eat white man's bread and honey for my lunch because I wouldn't eat the lunch ordinarily by myself. So those are the kind of things that our discussion will bring about so people can understand what it's like for the first time for some of us.
Well, good. Yeah, we'll talk a bit more about that a bit later in the interview. Yes, some fascinating things, yeah.
We're also having our artist exhibit, and that's going to be every day of the week except Sundays until October 31st. And that's right here at the Sebastopol Library on Bodega Avenue. And there's pieces from Christine, Sandy, and Stanley Malachay. More opportunities to experience our culture, but more through different types of art forms, some photography, some paintings. There's even a large quilt that's in the exhibit. And so being able to have our culture in a contemporary art form and being able to have people of all ages, all demographics, be able to go to a library and learn a little bit about our culture, it's really nice to have that representation.
When you're going around Sonoma County, a lot of, per se, white people you meet, they still don't know that there's Indians here, I imagine. Is that still the case? They're pretty ignorant of that fact?
I think so. I, on the side from my own work that I do, kind of like my professional job in a sense, besides that job that I have, I do a lot of cultural presentations in preschools and elementary schools. And I actually was able to do my first assembly setting with almost 200 kids today. And I had a lot of the same questions being repeated of, I thought you lived in teepees, or I thought Indian people owned horses, and, you know, just these different things. And in a sense, you know, some people in our community might see that as, oh, these people are ignorant, or, you know, they don't know nothing. But I try my best to put myself in their shoes and try to understand, because for me, I don't know a lot of cultures besides my Indian culture, because I've grown up so strongly within my culture, just being around baskets and dance and food and jewelry and, our Thule boats in Lake County, like all these different things. Like I'm at home when I'm around those things because that's how I grew up.
Right.
But if I was in, surrounded by another culture, I feel that I might have the same assumptions about someone else's culture because I don't have that awareness, because they're not being represented the best way that they can, which is understandable, because for me, Sonoma County is like a big melting pot. Like there's so many different variations of people just in general, in people fall into, you know, all these different categories, but we shouldn't have to try to fit into a category. We should all be able to sit in a space and learn from each other. Don't matter our age, our gender, what we look like, what we believe in, to just sit and learn together about one thing. That's all we need to do. And it's not hard to try to create that space for other people, because then when we take the time to help educate people, then it's showing its effort from both ways, right, and we're able to learn and understand each other better and be aware of one another.
Exactly. Great words, great sentiments that, my goodness, it sounds so easy, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Just sit down and talk, you know.
I wish it was that easy.
I know. But now it's interesting, you both, now Molin and Rose, both obviously grew up in Indian culture, but Molin obviously a couple of generations prior. So between the two of you, how do you see the differences in that, and say how Rose grew up and say how you did?
Yeah, so I'm 74 years old now, and I remember the older folks to us were always doing working in some way. So when I saw my older people, they were doing something, it was working. And there was a lot of things for them to do as work. I mean, at one time there was hops were very prevalent here in our area.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of hop picking that went on. Not the best conditions to work in, it's a hot and terrible place to be, but it was a time when I saw people getting together, working together as a family, hard. It was hard
oh, yeah,
picking hops. Matter of fact, we didn't want to pick hops. But there was apples that we had to do, apples and pears and grapes and picking beans. Mm. So I saw a generation as totally different. I mean, sometimes they could only speak Indian language and they wouldn't have a lot of other language around. There certainly was no phones, telephones, right, for sure, and no computers. And so my wife is fairly close to my age. And so I finally got her a phone maybe 20 years ago. It was a simple phone, not the complex one.
Yeah.
So, but she had to learn how to do texting, because children these days text.
Right.
You don't phone them.
That's
they'd
right.
rather get a text, whether it's upstairs or in the back of the car. So my wife, in order to communicate with the young, had to text. So that's a big difference.
Okay.
And so older folks in our area don't like computers themselves. And use simple phones, and if they have a complex phone, they only use one thing, phoning. They don't play the games. They don't Facebook. They don't do tweet and all those things like that. They are basically. So that's the difference, is that we didn't have those electronics. And it seemed like there was more being closer together. Mm. Talking was the main thing that was different. Now they talk on the communication things, and they use the cell phones to Facebook, and so that's the difference between me and maybe and Rose. So
right, but now you know one of the big things of families and people getting together is the family meals. Is that continued still, or tried to be through this through the technological haze?
I feel like it depends on the family, because some families are a lot closer, and some families just have very busy schedules. Right. Like me and my dad, we only have dinner maybe a couple times during the actual like working week, just because I drive for my after school program, and so some days I'm not off of work until 7, and because Unfortunately, my dad is diabetic, so he needs to have food at a certain time to take his medications. I kind of take the advantage of my good health of just, I'll eat whenever I have the chance, you know. But I do try to make my best effort to still sit with my dad and talk with my dad, because my dad is not an elder yet, but I know a lot of people in my family see him as an elder because of a lot of his teachings that he has to offer. And so I try to make my best effort to sit with him, and at least, even if it's like a grapes or just a snack, or just sitting and, you know, sharing coffee in the morning, just simple things like that. But I definitely see, I'm 22, and I see a big difference, but with the kids, well, with the young adults that I work with, because twice a week I'm with third to sixth graders for work, and then the other 2 days I'm with seventh to 12th graders. And so even with them, like, I see a difference between how close they are with their siblings and how they view their parents and their grandparents. Like, some of the kids are, like, very, very close to their grandparents, and they visit them and they talk with them, and, again, they have meals with them. And some of their grandparents still live on the reservation, or they live out of California, and they don't have that that same advantage. So they lose a lot of that, I guess, stronger family dynamic in that way.
Right.
And my grandpa's still alive. He's in his later 70s. And I still make time in between work and school and things to go and sit and have lunch with him, because I was always taught when I was little that our elders are our teachers. And so anything that they have to share with us is important. And I feel like even if all my grandpa can tell me is a joke one day, or, you know, he wants to talk about, you know, when he used to watch Indian dancing when he was little, like, I try to take the time to sit and listen to that, because I know that a lot of my other relatives, we all have busy lives, and we all can't take that time all the time to sit and listen to these stories. So I try my best just personally to sit with any elders of my community and listen to what they have to say, because I feel a lot of us as young people, we have so many distractions. Like Mullen had mentioned, the phone, like, a lot of my kids can be in the same van, and I'm taking them home, and they're texting each other, and they're just two or three seats away
in the van,
you know, and I think, like, well, you know, how would this have been for my grandpa? I try to think of it in that way, because my dad, he didn't grow up having a computer or having a phone. And a lot of his younger childhood, he lived on the reservation with a lot of his relatives, up in Kashaya, and that wasn't a thing for them. They just go outside, play, run around.
Yeah.
Where now, it's just different. It's just, everything is really different. But I hope we try to stay as connected as possible, because that's how our Indian community is, and our families are the same, is that if we're not there to take care of someone, like our kids or nieces or nephews, whoever it is, there's always other relatives that are there to kind of help one another.
Right.
Yeah.
Younger, we all stayed together at the table, eating at the table. But when my mother died, things went different. And we kind of ate at the table, then ate other places also, not at the table. And so our family now, when, with my wife now and our kids, they had the same thing. When they were young, they sat at the table. But now, as they get older, they don't sit at the table anymore. So that whole thing has just changed for us. I don't know.
Right.
And it's individual families that do it themselves.
It seems, you know, part of certain Indian life is telling stories, telling history amongst, you know, to the generations. Is that still going on? You know, obviously you said, like, you know, you sit down with your grandparents and try and catch things they say. Is that still going on?
Yes, it's still going on, and that's the way history is passed on to many of us.
Yeah.
And it's about our family, for sure. You know, who's who? Because somebody asked me the other day, you know, how far back can you go on your DNA and all that kind of, well, we didn't have that, you know. And it's they weren't involved in DNA. And you have to rely on relatives to say, this is your relative. So that still kind of goes on. And they pass down stories all the time. And I try to do it myself to my kids so that they know kind of things of the future for us.
Right. That's so important. Don't want to just read it in a book. It's got to come from the people who are experiencing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the key. And that's what you two are doing. You're keeping it real. How many Indians are in the Sonoma County area? What is the...
I think the latest survey showed about 8,000 Indians in Sonoma County itself. And so that's the misnomer because, you know, who is an Indian for one thing?
Right.
How many people call themselves Indian? If you have Indian blood, if you know Indian. So, but the real definition of Indian is you must be a member of a tribe. And to be a member of a tribe, several things happen. You have to have blood quantum. Some people just have 25% blood and you're a member of the tribe. Some people have just any kind of blood, any particular relation. So you have to have membership in the tribe and be a member of the tribe in order to be called Indian. So the number of 8,000 doesn't necessarily mean who is an Indian, who can qualify as an Indian. So it's a much smaller amount overall.
Ah, interesting.
And we don't call, although Indians from Mexico may come, or from Canada, or other places, United States, we don't call them Indians. Although there be Indians in the sense of anthropological sense, in the U.S., they're not an Indian.
Right.
But on the census, they would say Indian.
That famous census coming up. Yes, that's going to be a mess. But now, a moment, let's talk about your background a bit. I know you spent most of your adult life in the Indian healthcare system. And tell us something about that and, you know, how it works and how it integrates with the rest of the world's healthcare system.
I'm sick now. I'm kidding.
It's enough to make you sick.
When I grew up here in Sonoma County. I was in the 50s, 40s, and 50s. There wasn't health care then. So we didn't have access to health care. We had to go to the county, if the county would what it said in there, and project ourselves. We only went two times, basically when we were born and when we're ready to die. Those are the times you went to the hospital for the most part. Right. But for the most part, we didn't. So health care kind of started in 1969 when six tribes in California went back to Washington and said, there is no health care here. You have to provide health care. The feds. So the feds did not do it. So those six tribes was able to get about $300,000 to start a little program for those six programs. So it went from 6 to 9 to 25 and 45. So there's about 45 health programs in California now that are fully feds health care. Doing much more than they did before, you know, and it's not just health, but there's dental and mental. There's all kinds of health care that almost every of those tribes are providing. And they're getting reimbursed to some degree. I mean, they're not totally money-making, so it would make money, but providing care to the people. And so that's the main thing that we're getting now is they're getting health care, qualified health care from providers, from health. And so our system here in Sonoma is the Sonoma County Indian Health. That started out very small, Now, it's a fairly large program.
Oh, yeah.
Providing tremendous care to all levels of the organizations, from small to even seniors. So it's grown quite a bit, and I'm very happy. I just attended the Round Valley Indian Health Center, and they had a 50-year anniversary just 2 weeks ago.
Mm.
That's a long time to provide health care, 50 years. And so I was able to help go up there and celebrate with them 50 years of providing health care. And they're one of the first ones to do that. So health care, and their health care has really improved themselves from where they were before. People are much healthier now than they were in the past. We're not where we should be, but we're better than they were before.
Well, compared to having no health care treatment, literally.
Yes.
That is... one of the big topics, obviously, talking about healthcare, we can talk about, because I know obviously it affects Rose as well, the whole opioid and drug addiction that's going on, obviously, in the whole population, not just in Indians. What are you seeing?
That's a very big topic at this point, because many, many people are affected by health care, and they're giving products that they shouldn't be getting. That's basically it. The doctors are trying to provide pain relief, and they're using these medications that cause people to be drug addicts, not only here in Santa Rosa, but all the counties throughout the United States. So it's a very, very big problem. And it's kind of like Michael Jackson. You know, he had a problem, and he had enough money to get care that most people wouldn't get, right. And he overdid it, and that's what's happening today. People are overdoing it. They don't know it. When I was a director at the health clinic, people would knock on my door any time and say, I'm not getting my health care. I said, you got the prescription that lasts 20 days, but you're coming back in 10 days because, and I heard all the excuses. The dog ate it, thrust on the toilet, lost it somewhere, you know, all kind of, expecting me to tell the doctor to give him those drugs. And I could tell then this is a big problem. There's a big problem all over. People are hurting. They need the relief of some kind, but they're getting that kind of stuff that they shouldn't be getting. So kind of around January of last year, a big push nationwide was to put suits against those drug companies because they far, far exceeded what they're doing. So a big push is to have tribes and health programs sue them. So there's a big meetings all over California saying, what do we do? How do we go with, you know, and all the providers of lawyers were saying we can do it. So that was a big push at one time. So it's happening all the time. It's very painful to see people in pain.
Yeah.
And they need pain and relief in some way. But there are other avenues other than drug. Most people want a drug or a pill to make things happen, go away, and they overdo it when it doesn't do enough. But there are other ways to do it, and they're forming committees now at health centers to talk about alternatives to drugs themselves.
Hmm.
So there are other ways to do it also.
Excellent. Yeah, I can't just turn the eye to this thing, can you, at all? And how are you seeing it, you know, amongst the younger kids, what's happening in that world?
Well, kind of to go a little bit off of what Mullen was talking about, it's definitely an epidemic for our communities. I feel because especially all of our young people that look into social media and, you know, rappers, singers, actresses, all these people are usually in their music or in their videos are talking about drugs they're just talking about all kinds of different things.
Yeah.
But you know, drugs is definitely a big thing and just different forms of drinking. And I feel because it's so like that culture is so strong for them through social media that outrules a lot of our cultural community. And because our youth are seeing this all the time, for them it's normalized. It's not something that is an issue, right? Because they see everybody talking about it. They see everybody doing it outside of social media. In some cases, it's happening in our community, or it's happening at home, or it's happening at a relative's house, whatever it is. But it's an issue, and it's something that we need to realize is an issue, and not just sweep it under the rug. And unfortunately, and I've dealt with this in a personal sense, not through drugs and alcohol, but just going to counseling, when my own mother passed away earlier this year in January. Oh. Just the stigma in our community that comes with going to a clinic for help, because it's, for some reason, it's seen as something so negative.
Right.
And I think, just speaking on my behalf, sometimes it's almost easier to turn to those negative outlets than to get real help from a clinic, or even right. For some people, just going to sweat, that's their way of grieving and going through things, or people in our community going to Roundhouse and different things, because for us that are real strong in our faith and in our culture, that is our therapy, you know, being able to hear our songs and our dances and smelling the medicine or smelling the food, sitting and laughing with our relatives. That's all of those things together is healing. But because not all of our young people have access to these types of ceremonies, and they're seeing all this stuff in social media, which they're on all the time because their phone is their everything. And I feel like because it's so normalized, again, you know, would rather seek those opportunities than seek real counseling. And I wish that our young people would normalize that it's okay to get help. Like Mullen had said, sometimes their self-medication is just going too far. And we do have youth in our community that commit suicide. Mm-hmm. We have youth in our community that cut and hurt themselves in those ways. And those are both unhealthy. Sad, but I feel it's also our opportunity for people that do work with youth so much. We need to step up and be there for our youth when they're doing these things. Right. And especially if they're the ones coming to us and telling us that they're struggling or that they're doing these things to themselves. You know, in some cases, some people might get overwhelmed and just ignore it. And then something else could happen, or they turn, right, you know, to the drugs and the drinking. And so I think it's just, at least for us that work with youth all the time or are around youth all the time, like, we need to be able to be accountable for what our youth tell us, because whether we want to, if it's like ignore it or kind of like brush it under the rug, or, you know, we want to normalize that kids are resilient and that kids, right, kids can't feel this way. They can't feel pain and stuff. But not that I'm a youth, but I'm a younger adult, and a lot of my youth are around my age. And to think that a 13 or 17 or even, you know, a youth that's 9 and 10, to know that they struggle with depression, that they've thought about hurting or harming themselves, that they have cut or that they've thought of committing suicide. These are real issues that are in our community. And when people really turn to the social media that talk so much about these things happening in our community, a lot of the times they just, oh, that can't be real. What would make a 9-year-old want to hurt themselves or take their own lives? Right. But again, it's us who needs to be accountable to see the signs that our youth are struggling, because that's how we're going to help them.
I suppose a lot of it goes back to dignity and respect and pride in yourself at, having that built in from the beginning, isn't it? And I think that goes with one of your comments about feeling like you're living a separate life, mm-hmm, as well. You've got the bifurcated life of an Indian life and a white life as well.
Definitely.
And so that must cause a lot of confusion.
One to mention is, I was the president of an organization called NAMI, National Association of Mental Illness. And that's an association that most people don't know about. So Rose talked about symptoms that sometimes we don't even know or see that it's there. So I'm just going to talk about some of these symptoms that what we talk about in mental health, and so people can know that if you have somebody like this is doing this, there's probably something wrong. And NAMI is an organization that deals with really higher up or totally confused mental health that has something done to your brain. You can't do anything about it. You know it's there, but what do you do about it? So if you have something, buddy, that's always tense and nervous, intimidating or critical, they're unpredictable, they don't care, or they're non-flexible, they have they're not eating, or they're throwing up, and they're deep worries of fear, they're missing school quite a bit, extremely disorganized, confusing at work or school, rudeness and hostility, fear, and they can't make decisions. So that's few of the thing. There's right. About 30 of those that are available. And so if you have someone like that, you probably have someone has acute mental disorder. We don't realize that in our community, Indian community, but it's there. Mm. I was a teacher in that organization for a while. I did it while I did my working for Indian Health. But I did this as a second organization to help people. Parents who have children like that want to say, how do I solve the problem? Because it's not just a drug that will do it. It's not an organization. I had parents whose kids were graduates of Stanford or UCLA or some big school. They were musicians. But when in their 20s, something happened and had that mental disorder. So they're now doing drugs, selling their bodies. So the parents were saying, how could that happen? This was a happy young girl at one time, or happy young person. And so there's a course they had, a 12-week course for parents. And so I remember I had a class of 30 people, and they all came in. How do I help my son, or mostly son or daughter? Most of them were son or daughters. They thought this was a class that would if they took it, it would change things around for them. But there's no changing this mental illness.
Right.
Those who take it, one-third will sometimes get better. One-third will stay the same, and one-third of them will get worse. Mm. But this was a course on teaching parents on how to deal with this person. How to deal, because this person was, they were stealing, cussing, doing things on them. They're doing all kinds of nasty things to their parents, stealing their food, right. Televisions. Selling their bodies, and so it's hard for persons to say, what do I do now?
Yeah.
They don't come out of the room to eat. So how do I help them? So the most encouraging thing to me of this 12-week course was 9 weeks, the persons who took the course began to see they had to make the changes in their life to accept all the nasty things or dirty things that they saw in their kids. So that was very enlightening. Mm. When they saw that, it was kind of the most encouraging thing for me and in kind of teaching I understand. They have now learned a better way. They didn't help their kid out necessarily, but they heard on how to do it. And right. So there's a lot of Indian kids. So if you have children like that, take them to this thing called NAMI or something. They have courses on for parents and kids, and it's an advantageous. So mental health, very big thing.
Yes.
We don't think it is, but it's very, very important to our families altogether.
Oh, it's totally unfunded or underfunded, basically.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, how do people get hold of, go and check that out?
Well, there's a course, NAMI is a national organization. It's headquartered in Washington, D.C., but they have state organizations in every state of the United States. So there's an organization in Sacramento that's the national, but every county except a few, and Lake County doesn't have it, but Sonoma County has a very good program here in town. So it's a NAMI, NAMI, National Association of Mental Illness. So you can call then or call. You can only if you can also call in if you have problems. You can call in to some community worker. How do I do this? So there's various programs that they have to get involved in this kind of program.
Now, one thing you mentioned as a topic was the, I don't know anything about, is the Indian Child Welfare Act. What's the implications of that?
The Indian Child Welfare Act was 40 years old in 1978, what it started, because so many kids, Indian kids, were being taken away from their homes.
Mm.
About a third of the generation of kids were removed from their homes because they didn't think Indian parents or people could take care of kids. So this act was passed in 1978 saying that if you have an Indian kid and your family, you could use this act to say that kid could come to your family because it's advantageous for a kid to come into a family that they know, not into another family that they don't know, another culture. So that the idea was that the Indian Child Welfare Act would permit kids to stay in a family or an Indian family for sure or a tribe. And so just about first part of October, a judge in northern Texas ruled against that ICWA. And it was a little child who was Cherokee and a Navajo. So the two-year-old, he had the ability to become a member of the Navajo tribe, but I'm just going to say it's not proper to say non-Indian, but a non-Indian people took that kid and went against the ICWA and won the case. So the kid couldn't go to Navajo or anybody else. And the judge overruled the idea of Indian Child Welfare Act, meaning it had no meaning there. And so it's only in Texas.
Huh.
But several learned people are saying they have to just bring it to a higher court, make it more invalid. And there's a group in Arizona, kind of funded by wealthy Arizonans that don't like Indians necessarily, and have been trying to do away with this act for a long time. So they're very, very happy that this took place. And so there's a very good concern that this may change how the federal government treats Indians altogether. There's some concern that if the Indian Child Welfare Act goes to a higher court and even to the Supreme Court, which we know now here has a different flavor,
makeup, yes.
That things could change totally for Indian, providing care to Indians. In health care, gaming could be excluded under this title if they don't make it happen. Healthcare also. So all the things that the government does for Indians would be totally eliminated if this totally happens. And would require an extra step, bring it to a higher court or to somebody else. And so it should be looked at by all Indians because it's not just the Indian Child Welfare Act. That's very important, that should stay. That may be blown out, and other things may happen to healthcare. So it's a very
from that, yeah.
It could be very distasteful for Indians if that were to happen.
Well, you know, talking about the global picture, obviously a year and a half ago we had Standing Rock, and that created a huge upswelling. What has been the reverberations and echoes of that since then?
Just Standing Rock in general was a good movement just because it brought the Indian communities a lot of the media attention that has been needed. Because we hear and see about so many other issues in all types of communities. There's even news stations that my grandpa watches at his care home where it's like world news. And I always wondered, like, they never talk about our issues that are going on in our communities. And so to be able to turn on my news and see something about our community and something that we face so much, and a lot of our communities, even here in California, for a while were struggling with having clean water or having access to water at all. Right. You know, especially when a few of our reservations in Lake County and Mendocino County had the fires, not everybody was able to access evacuation centers and waters and clean clothes and different things like that. And it, you know, correlates with Standing Rock because, it was such a tragic thing that was going to happen to the community, and to see so many Indian people from so many places around the world come together all on one cause, it gave a message to our Indian people, as well as, even though we're in a more modern time, it's still not too late for us to come together when it is for good work, right. To stand for something that we all believe in, and that's to have clean water. Because if people want to look at it in a scientific way, we're almost 100% water.
Right.
And so to think that you don't want people to have access to clean water, that's like saying you don't have access to being a healthy person. Right. Goes back to at least my older generations not even having anything close to having any kind of health care. And now, cause I'm a person who goes to our Sonoma County Indian Health quite a bit, and to be able to have access to so many different programs and classes, and even just like walk-in classes, like a lot of clinics, you know, like Kaiser, for example, I'm not too familiar with, but I haven't heard in our community where people can just walk in and go to a class. You know, you have to have insurance, or you have to have the card, or you have to pay fees. And where Indian Health, you can drop in and, you know, go to classes, and there's stuff. There's talking circles on mental health. They have talking circles for people who are trying to be clean and sober, kind of like 12-step programs, but involving our culture. They have the breastfeeding council that counsels young mothers on, the cultural significance and also the healthy benefits of being able to breastfeed. They have all the mental health programs for the young, and we have the senior center at Indian Health, which the elders can go and do crafts, or they can eat lunch together. Sometimes they have, they plan out parking lot sales, and, you know, just all these different elements for our community to be able to be a part of there, to know that it's so easier to access it now than how it was for our elders. It's nice to see all these different, positive things going on for our community.
We've been having Molin Molokay and Rose Hammock here of the, Pomo Honoring Month. Just a rundown, what's coming up tomorrow and Sunday?
October 13th, tomorrow at 2 o'clock, we're going to be having our workshop with Buffy Schmidt, who is Pomo, and she's going to be doing a twine basket workshop at our Central Sonoma County Library in the Forum Room. That address is 211 East Street in Santa Rosa. The next day on Sunday, October 14th at noon, the Sonoma County Pomo dancers with their dance leader Joe Salinas will be in the Sebastopol's Farmers Market, which is right at the Sebastopol Gazebo, and that's 6908 Weeks Way here in Sebastopol. And then to close up our month, we were able to collaborate with CIMCC, the California Indian Museum and Cultural Center, on our forum with Pomo elders, and that is in Santa Rosa, and that's 5250 Arrow Drive. And also, people still have time to visit our artist exhibit. That's Monday through Saturday, until October 31st, and that is at the Sebastopol Library here in Sebastopol. That's 7140 Bodega Avenue. And there's artwork in there from Christine Koba, Sandy East Oak, and Stanley Malakay.
Wonderful. I encourage everybody to get out there and see them all. It's going to be a lot of fun. Thank you, Molin. Now, I noticed, Molin, that somebody called Stanley Malakay is going to be doing... is that a relative of yours?
Yeah, Stan was an older brother of mine that passed on, but a very fine artist. Fine artist.
So, well, thank you, Molin Molokay and Rose Hammock, for coming in and celebrating with us Pomo Honoring Month. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.